impulses are being redirected. We are living in an artificially induced state of consciousness that resembles sleep.
Precognitive
dissonance.
Welcome aboard, everybody.
Welcome.
This is Smiles Lewis.
And I'm Craig York, introducing himself twice because I'm Craig York, to make up for last week's complete absence of an introduction.
Wow, I'd forgotten about that.
I'm an elephant, Miles.
Huh.
No, really, I'm an elephant.
In the living room?
No. I mean, look, you know, I mean, I've got these four massive pillar-like legs. I've got a trunk, passion for peanuts, and massive tusks.
I'm sure that's not all that's massive.
Oh, dude, thank you.
Elephantitis and all.
In the native of Fiji. We've all seen the photograph, but you can probably find it online someplace if you haven't. Oh, heavens to Betsy, I can hear myself think. That's a scary thought.
All right. Well, that's a much better level there.
Yeah.
And thank you for joining us live from Austin, Texas. This is Precognitive Dissonance. .com.
The show that dares you.
To what?
I don't know. I was about to say to think, and it just struck me that, you know, no, we don't dare anybody to think. I think it's pretty much a given that they can and do. But, you know, that's enough patter now for the news.
Okay, breaking news, actually. April 3rd, Wired, or excuse me, not Wired, boingboing.net, Rupert Sheldrake stabbed in leg at conference. I just got notified of this afternoon. Some friends of mine from local consciousness organizations that I'm a part of, they were returning from New Mexico from their trip to the 10th annual Science and Consciousness Conference, at least I think that's the name of the conference.
Mm-hmm.
And they informed me, so did you hear about Sheldrake? I'm like, well, what about Sheldrake, as in Rupert Sheldrake? And they said that he was stabbed at the conference. I'm like, holy crap.
I've been scanning this, and it's kind of like a member of the audience apparently was somewhat disgruntled and put a knife in his leg.
Yeah.
He was taken out on a gurney. Hirano Kazuki, 33, of Yokohama, Japan, spent Wednesday night in jail after he was arrested on charges of aggravated battery and assault with intent to commit a violent felony. He provided no resistance as officers led him in handcuffs from the hotel.
And there's several descriptions from people about his activities before the conference, before the stabbing incident. It says Hirano had been attending the 10th International Conference on Science and Consciousness. Other attendees said he had been acting oddly. They said he confronted Sheldrake earlier this week, telling him he heard voices and saw demons. Another featured speaker at the conference told the man he was, quote, full of negative energy, and counseled him to calm down, said Evan Meacham, an attendee from Broomfield, Colorado. Another attendee, David Graves of Tel Aviv, Israel, said he had tried to talk to Hirano earlier in the conference, but he did not respond. On Tuesday, Graves said he watched Hirano as he sat on a bench, rocking back and forth like an Orthodox Jew in prayer. Why the hell would he attack that guy? He asked.
Why the hell would they use a euphemism like that? People rock back and forth for all kinds of reasons, but...
Well, because the guy who's saying it is from Israel. I mean, that's...
Oh, okay.
But, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, that's kind of...
Okay.
The journalist trying
Never
to be literary.
Never mind. Yeah. Well, you know, I'm sorry. I should be ashamed of myself for letting my knee jerk like that. Refresh my memory. I noticed the phrase morphic resonance, but apart from a vague connection, I have no idea who Rupert Sheldrake is.
Fantastic. Rupert Sheldrake is, well, I believe he's a biologist. They've got his credentials somewhere around here. But he wrote several books, one of which was dubbed by either Nature or New Scientist or some other science magazine, Book Most Fit for Burning.
Ooh.
And his basic premise is that there aren't so much laws of nature as there are habits of nature, and that without saying that such morphic fields are actual physical reality fields in the sense of electromagnetic fields,
mm-hmm.
but more in terms of informational fields, that the laws of nature are actually habits, that they are worn grooves of behavior, of habit, of the universe itself. And this can lead to actually some rather, I guess it's Lamarckian-style interpretations of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
But it actually seems to provide a logical framework for such a wild-eyed idea as just the things are the way they are because they've been that way for a long time, and that it's hard to make the universe work in a new way if it's already got a certain pattern. I mean, mm-hmm. if you think about the idea of empirical science being all about reproducing, you know, one person's experiment because the universe is the same everywhere and you should be able to recreate it given the same formula and procedures, that's logical, but then that's assuming that the laws of reality are the same everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And,
you know, from the general to the particular, most human beings are law-abiding.
So Rupert Sheldrake has proposed this hypothesis of formative causation, and that invokes the idea of these morphic fields, which again are not necessarily something real and physical, but that are informational.
And I'm going to start calling it criminal consciousness or criminal reality.
And in fact, in a lot of ways, I believe. Though I don't know if Jacques Vallée has ever particularly cited Sheldrake's work. I know they've got to know each other, and I've always felt that it Vallée's perspective on the subject of UFOs was rather inspired by the kind of thinking of Rupert Sheldrake.
Mm-hmm.
Some of his more recent research has involved things like the effect of being observed, and he's been thinking up new parapsychological experiments all the time, some involving like the classic synchronicity of, you know, thinking of somebody you haven't thought of in years and the phone rings and it's them.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of a basic synchronicity. He's tried to design some experiments using cell phones and email for the exact same kinds of phenomena and seeing, you know, if more than chance would predict and that there would be people reporting that exact
I'm with you.
Type of
I'm
thing.
With you.
So he's just somebody who I've always just been incredibly enamored with his approach and his rationality at the same time of having things, ideas that are fundamentally opposite of mainstream. It's led to some fascinating research. He's also really famous because of his experiments. One of his books is Seven Experiences. No, they totally mistitled it. They did this earlier. Look at this. Okay.
Seven experiences that could change the world.
Wrong. Okay, that same paragraph. This is at SantaFeNewMexican.com. Sheldrake's keynote address was titled Memory and Morphic Resonance. That's probably correct. And his workshop was Fields of the Mind, Experimental and Research and Practical Intuition. I bet you that that's experimental research and practical intuition.
Mm-hmm.
They just added an extra and in there.
Yeah.
According to a catalog on the conference, which began Monday and concluded today, Sheldrake, described as a biologist with a doctorate degree, is the author of Seven Experiments That Could Change the World, is what that should read.
Okay.
One of the other experiments that he's famous for is monitoring pets, particularly cats and dogs, to see if they in any way show a pattern of knowledge beyond the main senses of their knowing their owners are on their way home. And that's led to some fascinating data that definitely seems like one of those species seems more inclined to it. But what was interesting was that it didn't seem to... it wasn't... The point at which the dogs, I believe, came to start acting like they were expecting their owners to come home was the moment at which, wherever their owner had been, they had determined to go home. Like, and so, you know, they might get held up, you know, by something that intervenes, but that point in their day where they said, you know.
Yeah, I'm getting on the bus or I'm getting in the car. I can certainly see that.
Interesting stuff to me.
Well, you know, there's plenty of anecdotal stories about dogs sensing the moment of their owner's death. You know.
Oh, yeah.
And there was that bit not too terribly long ago, around on the net a number of places, but I remember it also showing up in 14 times about the cat in the nursing home in Wisconsin, was it?
That visits people before they
shortly
die.
Shortly before they die.
It's stealing their breath.
Old wives' tale. Cats don't do that.
They've sat on my chest and breathed their stinky kitty breath into my face.
Well, you know, that's why I have the nose I do. Odors get lost in it, and I'm much happier.
Oh, man. So, yeah, okay. That was...
Now I'm a little more...
I'm going to send you home with a Sheldrake book.
Okay. I picked up a couple of books at the Library Book Bazaar today. One of them is on a disastrous Arctic expedition of 1881. You know, I've been on kind of an Arctic and Antarctic kick of late. Did I mention the book The Terror on the Air?
I don't think you did mention it on the air. We talked about it before the show, I think.
A recent novel by a fellow named Dan Simmons, apparently known for his horror, although he also writes science fiction. And I had read a book called Hyperion by him 8-10 years ago, so the name was vaguely familiar. The Terror is actually the name of one of two ships, Erebus and Terror, that were lost and most likely never seen again, as were all the members of the expedition. There is one surviving log note left in a cairn, a mound of stones, along their route that basically said they were abandoning the ships and striking out for northern Canada. But The Terror is basically a fictionalized account of these last 2 years of these men's lives. That's how long they were believed to be missing before they actually succumbed. And it's a pretty interesting read.
Yeah, what you've told me about it intrigued me, and wasn't there an account related to that you read on air here on Anomaly Radio on one of the audiobook hour?
The Ship Seen on the Ice, a chapter in the book Oddities by Rupert Gould. And
Rupert!
Anyway.
It is an associational universe, folks.
Like I said, the Erebus and Terror were lost after 1846, and I think in 1850 or 1851, a ship crossing the Atlantic saw an iceberg in the North Atlantic with a pair of ships basically stuck on it, one almost upright, the other what's called on its beam ends, which is basically on its sides, on a side. And, you know, it's presumed that these might have been the Erebus and Terror. The ship that actually made the sighting, for whatever reason, did not attempt to approach the iceberg. Anyway, The Terror by Dan Simmons.
I definitely have a lesser-known fetish, a Fortean fetish for, I guess, mystery ship stories.
I'm just
realizing this just now. What a revelation. My friend Robert Larson once wrote for Fate magazine an article about, I think it's called Pearl in the Desert, and it's a story about a ship, a legendary ship in the desert filled with Spanish gold or something, some such, that got there by way of some inland river lake that spontaneously closed off its into how they got in.
Yeah, I think I know the story. It's a branch of the Colorado, or that might actually be the Colorado, out of the Gulf of California.
Sounds likely, yeah.
yeah. That's also, I think I remember one or two just very brief reports of a Chinese junk being seen somewhere in the Death Valley Desert.
Cool.
Yeah.
Man.
But, yeah, ghost ships are wonderful stuff. I also listened recently to a book called exactly that, Ghost Ship, which purported to finally solve the mystery of the Mary Celeste, the famous ghost ship found abandoned in the mid-Atlantic later in the 19th century, 1871. 1871. And the subject of all kinds of what-ifs. The best explanation is that the captain may have ordered the ship temporarily abandoned because of concern over leakage of the cargo, which was all alcohol. And nobody's really sure, but it appears not to have been potable alcohol. So, But there are a host of conspiracies ranging from, of course, a giant squid to alien abduction to more prosaic things like mutiny and abandonment, dementia in the crew, any one of a number of things. But it's one of those excellent mysteries it's beautifully documented. The circumstances, the facts are known, the circumstances are speculation.
Yeah, I love that stuff.
And there will never be an absolute proof. It will always be a mystery. I like that.
I gotta live with it.
They're here. Another NewScientist.com news service note from Zia Merali. The mechanism of poltergeist activity.
I haven't really had the chance to read this.
I just glanced over it. The sight of small blonde girls watching television is guaranteed to strike fear into the heart of anyone who has watched the movie Poltergeist or has met my granddaughter. We're right to be terrified, say physicists. Children generate poltergeist activity by channeling energy into the quantum mechanical vacuum. Piero Provetto, whose last known address was the Istituto Fischia Superiore in Cagliari.
Cagliostro.
Cagliari, Italy, and his colleague Vera Maxia wanted to explain the origin of poltergeist phenomena characterized by objects flying around the room of their own accord. The researchers note that poltergeist encounters have been reported around the world and across different cultures, but tend to have one thing in common. Quote, poltergeist disturbances often occur in the neighborhood of a pubescent child or a young woman, end quote, the authors note in their paper. So Brovetta and Maxia have come up with a mechanism to explain just how these women and children create such havoc. Like so many problems that arise in adolescence, puberty gets the blame. Puberty is a modification of the child body which involves various organs, chiefly the brain, they state. Would you scroll down, Miles? Thank you.
Scrolling.
Keep those columns, scroll them. Provetto and Maxia hypothesize that the changes in the brain that occur at puberty involve fluctuations in electron activity that in rare cases can create disturbances up to a few meters around the outside of the brain. These disturbances would be similar in character to the quantum mechanical fluctuations that physicists believe occur in the vacuum in which virtual particle and antiparticle pairs pop up for a fleeting moment before they annihilate each other and disappear again. Ooh. Brovetto and Maxia believe that the extra fluctuations triggered by the pubescent brain would substantially enhance the presence of the virtual particles surrounding the person. This could slowly increase the pressure of air around them, moving objects, and even sending them hurling across the room. The Poltergeist paper will appear in the journal Neuroquantology. We contacted Brian Josephson, a Nobel laureate physicist who is on the editorial board of Neuroquantology. This looks distinctly flaky to me, Josephson commented.
And there's a link to the document journal reference at arxiv.org/abs/0801.0382. I'm not repeating that, folks.
And we have Greg Bishop of UFO Mystic to thank for this. I believe he posted the original link on the UFO Mystic blog.
I think you are correct. I think that's where I first saw it. And the document you can download, and it's pretty interesting. Their own way of summarizing the research is, poltergeist accounts concern at least four kinds of strange spontaneous manifestations, such as burning of materials, failures of electrical equipment, rapping noises, and movement of objects. A simple analysis of phenomenology of these disturbances shows that they might have a common origin, that is, a reduction in strength of molecular bonds due to an enhancement in polarization of vacuum, which decreases the actual electron charge. Arguments based on Prigogine's non-equilibrium thermodynamics are proposed, which show how transformations in brain of some pubescent children or young women might be the cause of these effects. And it's not that long of a paper. It's about 8 pages, with a good 2 pages of that being appendices and
bibliography and notes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And there are some formulas, folks.
Ooh, shit, boy, howdy. Sorry. Anyway,
so I was pretty interesting.
It's a neat concept, and well, if it can be, you know, demonstrated experimentally, God, the implications are pretty staggering.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
As most of these psi-related paranormal, parapsychological phenomena are, and ufological phenomena, and non-mainstream UFO people have been of the opinion for quite some time that if you understand hauntings and poltergeist phenomena, you mm-hmm. could understand a lot more about UFO phenomena and close encounters. And we'll have more on that in the future.
Anomalism searches for a grand unified field theory.
UFO!
What?
A circle is measured beginning anywhere. UFO!
One measures the circle beginning anywhere.
Yeah.
What is reality? Does it, like gravity, decrease with the square of the distance traveled from the source?
Speaking of reality, let's bite into that reality sandwich. That's the new website magazine of that Daniel Pinchbeck guy. And they've got an article that's not all that new news, but you've probably been hearing about it a lot the last 6 to 9 months. And that is that people who've lost a limb but are still experiencing phantom limb syndrome or pain and irritation in that now departed appendage, there's new techniques for helping to minimize that phenomena, and it involves, of all simplistic things, a mirror. The article by Cal Cobalt starts, "Phantom limb pain consistently baffles the medical community. Theories abound as to its cause, but they are only conjecture, and no consistently effective treatment exists until now. Clinical trials of mirror therapy at Walter Reed Army Medical Center have yielded surprising and welcome results. Mirror therapy consists of positioning a mirror in such a way that the intact limb is reflected in the position of the amputated limb. Patients flex and stretch the intact limb while looking in the mirror, creating an illusion for the mind that both limbs are present. After 1 month of mirror therapy, all patients in the clinical trial reported, quote, significantly less phantom pain. Half the patients performing the same routine with the mirror covered experience an increase in pain, and those who only visualized the treatment experienced a 67% rate of decreased pain. When these patients were switched to mirror therapy, 90% experienced decreased pain. And they linked to another study, a similar study on mirror massage, seems to corroborate the results of this study. So I've been hearing a lot about this, and it's one of those, wow, okay.
Okay. Yeah, there's a basic explanation or rationale for the method in the last paragraph. By bringing the visual input in alignment with the body's proprioception in mirror therapy, the brain is tricked into thinking both limbs remain present. Misfiring lessens and pain decreases. And evidently the loss of the limb causes misfired neurons and synapses in the brain, which is the source of the pain.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's one of the articles over at realitysandwich.com, and I'd like to note that among the other cool authors they've got on staff are Eric Davis and Douglas Rushkoff, two people who've written a lot of things over the years that I find really fascinating about the new counterculture, the new mm-hmm. cyberculture, and in the case of Eric Davis, the occasional anomalous subject and its relation to such things.
Google is God looks awfully interesting, but probably not terribly anomalous. What else we got? You were...
Just on the subject of other therapies, this is a couple of weeks old, but it did catch my attention some weeks back. Army's new PTSD treatments, that's post-traumatic stress syndrome treatments, yoga, Reiki, and bioenergy. The military is scrambling for new ways to treat the brain injuries and post-traumatic stress of troops returning home from war, and every kind of therapy, no matter how far outside the accepted medical form, is being considered. The Army just unveiled a $4 million program to investigate everything from spiritual ministry, transcendental meditation, and yoga to bioenergy such as Qigong, Reiki, and distant healing to mend the psyches of wounded troops. As many as 17% of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans have some form of post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD, one congressional study estimates. Nearly 3,300 troops have suffered traumatic brain injury or TBI, according to statistics assembled last summer, and the lifetime cost of treating these ailments could pile up to as much as $35 billion, a Columbia University report guesses. I've seen other less mainstream but equally well-cited sources putting these numbers much higher than this.
Yeah.
Anyway, more like the percentage of troops returning, period, is with some kind of with disability is astronomical. And who could be surprised? Anyway, so small wonder then that the government is looking for alternate means to treat these injuries. The Defense Department is, quote, dedicated to supporting evidence-based approaches to medical treatment and wants to support the use of alternative therapies if there are proven efficacies. If they are proven efficacious, excuse me, notes a recently issued request for proposals. So that's over at blog.wire.com in their Danger Room, What's Next in National Security, from back on March 25th, Army's new PTSD treatments, yoga, Reiki, and bioenergy. All things that are not as flaky as you might think. I would implore anybody who's interested in getting to know their body better to look into all these things. And gosh darn it, I should be at least doing some yoga, because, man, every time I've done it, I felt so awesome.
I did it for a while and didn't notice a whole lot of effect, but, you know, I could not be more aware that it works for an awful lot of people. That's not to diss it in any way, shape, or form. I just, I wish my teeth would stop stinging. Yeah.
Another thing from March 25th, jumping over to UFOs, check this out.
Story now about UFOs. Not long ago, they were the talk, you'll remember, of the small North Texas town of Stephenville.
That's right. It was such a big story that we sent our Michael Gibson to Stephenville back in November to find out firsthand what folks there were saying.
I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Now, I'm 52 years old. I've never seen nothing like this in my life.
That's David Caron, and he captured some amazing video that became national and international news. Well, now a Corpus Christi man says that he spotted a UFO right here in the Coastal Bend over the weekend. Here's the story.
He doesn't want to be identified because he says he doesn't want to draw attention to himself. What this man does want is to share what he saw.
It got to a point that it was getting a little closer, and that's when I started to get a little bit more nervous.
This is what made him nervous, what he calls a UFO. He captured it on his cell phone. May not seem intimidating, but it certainly is different. The image looks like a white glowing spot moving around. At first, we were definitely skeptical. Is it a UFO? It could have been anything. But then we went back and looked at the video captured by residents in Stephenville, and look for yourself. There are some similarities, both objects moving back and forth and from side to side in the same manner.
Got to the point that it was close enough that one of my chihuahuas saw it, and I guess it was just trying to take care of me, or just natural instinct just to bark. And when it started to bark, that's when the light started to do that weird movement.
The man spotted this object Saturday night just outside of his home on the corner of Holly and Everhart. He says that it lingered in the skies for about 15 minutes.
I was by myself, you know. I may be a dude, but, you know, I ain't dumb. You know, I don't know if that was instincts of just not trying not to be seen. Maybe I watched too many movies. I don't know.
Too many movies or not, this man wanted to share the video with us to see if anyone else also spotted this object in the sky. He says he shared it with family and some friends, and they all say that it's definitely not a plane, satellite, or shooting star.
Yeah, at least make me feel like I'm not nuts, you know, or maybe I wasn't the only one that saw it.
So we're wondering if maybe you saw the same thing. If you did, shoot us an email to news@kiitv.com. You can also look at the video again by logging on to our website at kiitv.com and tell us.
And tell us what? What do you want us to tell you? Anyway, they're very similar. They moved side to side and up and down.
Yeah, and it's, you know, another blob of light with virtually no point of reference in the frame. Interesting, you know, but
yeah.
Not terribly useful as evidence of much of anything other than a blob of light. Also out of Stephenville is a somewhat more disturbing bit that supposedly it's on the Banal of America, I believe, that some witnesses were paid for their stories. I don't know. It's one of those. I'm not sure if there's a proven allegation here. But
do you remember which author it was?
No, but it's on The Anomalist.
As everything is.
Yeah, well, everything that matters.
Oh, here we go. Yeah, Stephen Wills with a capital sign.
And it opens with something that seems to be on a lot of people's minds, a lot of ufologists' minds these days. For years, I have laughed as certain people have accused ufologists of being in it for the money. However, recent happenings in Stephenville, Texas may have changed my mind. Not about most, though, just the few. There is a rumor, which seems to be true, that certain Stephenville witnesses were paid for exclusive interviews. I quote from Bill Burns' article, The Day After Stephenville, in the latest issue of UFO Magazine. In the face of open disclosure, however, there is always the possibility that disclosure can be bought, or witnesses' reports can be tied up with exclusive story and photo or footage agreements that make disclosure a business rather than a news story. And that's what's been happening in Stephenville as cult-centric ufologists come to town riding on their reputation to gather up every witness and every piece of footage they can find to broadcast it on their own websites and DVDs. At that point, disclosure goes private and becomes something of a business.
Is this accusation being leveled at Linda Howe?
I honestly don't know. And it's one of those... I don't know. I mean, there's an awful lot of people who get paid for their stories. Certainly, a lot of people get paid for the footage that they provide. You know, not all that uncommon. It's just, I think the implication here is almost that it might be more of an incentive for people to just make shit up, which, you know, people do.
Well, I could see a newspaper, even a mainstream one, and I think that's where a lot of this is being leveled at, is that, you know, there are mainstream news people who might want an exclusive scoop, and mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure Cox Communications is not above trying to license any and all footage that's submitted to them. I would bet you that every local news story, or excuse me, every local news station that takes tips from their viewers, listeners, mm-hmm. whatever.
Dirty rotten snitches.
They're soliciting, they're soliciting cell phone videos and any home videos and stuff.
Nosy Parkers.
And they're gonna, you know, I bet in the fine print, everything submitted becomes a property of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, and it's, I don't know, it's one of those. I understand where the author of the blog is coming from, and yeah, it definitely. It kind of diminishes the verisimilitude of a lot of reports, but it's one of those things you more or less have to expect that it's going to happen. Yeah.
Well,
guy writes a UFO book, one, because he wants to tell the story, and two, because he wants to get paid for it.
And more often than not, doesn't get paid very well.
No, that's certainly true.
This is Leslie's article for her Gray Matters column over at Ben All of America. She ends it with six questions that she's left with regarding these payouts. Number one, is it right for a few researchers with deep pockets to gather up exclusive witnesses and control the flow of information from them? Are witnesses less believable when they are paid? If this continues, will most witnesses in the future expect to be paid for their stories and withhold the information if they are not? Does it encourage people who saw nothing at all to make up stories? If this trend continues, what will become of ufologists that can't afford to pay witnesses? If this were an ethical practice, would I even have these questions?
It's a fair cop.
I like Leslie's perspective on this.
Yeah, yeah, like I say, I understand it. I don't think individual witnesses are necessarily the only source. Certainly they're an important source in some instances, but it seems to me like the material is going to disseminate one way or another. But, oops, there's those pesky drones again.
This is interesting to me. UFO cold case private investigators locate Chad drone photo location.
Mm-hmm.
There's a video that goes with this that is kind of interesting.
That's it, all right.
Where? Well,
you might scroll down a little bit. That strobing back and forth is.
Yeah, let me. Why don't you read that while I try to find this video?
Okay. This is at. Aliencasebook.blogspot.com. Photo overlay by Archangels. The photo above shows the location that the private investigators discovered, and it is exactly where the Chad drone was photographed. As previously reported here, link, the drone research team, DRT, affiliated with the Open Minds Forum, had hired private investigators Frankie Dixon and TK Davis in order to locate the Capitola drone. It appears that they were sent out to look for other drone locations as well. It is now being reported that private investigators have located the actual spot where the Chad drone was photographed. The drone research team, DRT, is composed of Tom01 UK, On the Fence, Tom01 UK is in the UK, On the Fence is in Canada, 10538 in the USA, Nemo492 France, Rasca, France, and 11 August, France. In earlier reports, it was stated that the Chad drone was somewhere around Bakersfield, but it appears that this is not the case. Originally, it was thought that Chad was trying to hide his location since the foliage in his photographs did not coincide with Bakersfield.
Well, I can't find the freaking video.
Oh, darn it.
Anyway, it was basically just, I think it was like Fox News or CNN interviewing these guys and explaining.
Just to remind people, the drone we're talking about here is the kind of air filter-looking drone with the onion-like spikes or threads coming up from the top of it and the asymmetrical wing arrangement around the ring. And also some kind of strange alien writing visible in close-ups on the wing.
And there's still ideas floating around out there that it's some kind of viral marketing campaign for something, or the other idea that it's, you know, yet another disinfo gambit by some professional military intel types, either trying to ferret out another mole or trying to somehow pull a psychological operation on the public, mm-hmm. or some segment thereof. Which brings me to an article I actually meant to talk about on the Tuesday night show with Mac, the PSYOP radio show. Are psychological operations PSYOPs used to influence public opinion of UFOs? Mm. It's not the exact take that I'm usually focusing on when I talk about UFOs and PSYOPs, but this was over at opednews.com by Franklin Fields. And he was talking about, in fact, a great deal of evidence for this reality has been accumulated. Evidence such as photographs, video footage, eyewitness testimony, physical evidence, and even captured ET ships have been acquired. Now, that's quite a bold assertion, Franklin. But still, there is a disagreement on the certainty of this evidence and its authenticity. Well, there you go. Why is there so much disagreement, and why won't the scientific and political community seriously examine the phenomena? One of the main reasons is the misinformation, deception, propaganda, and other social mechanisms being applied by different groups. These mechanisms, when part of a planned program, are termed psychological operations, PSYOPs. A PSYOP is a prescribed process used to induce or reinforce attitudes and behaviors favorable to an originator's interests. PSYOPs are routinely used by governments and militaries to effect change across the full spectrum of political, military, economic, and ideological actions. PSYOPs are so widely used that they may have become the most exploited means to achieve national objectives. Many governments routinely use them against their own citizens. Now, this article goes on, and it even gives a chart from out of the U.S. Army PSYOP leader reference chart. And
it's a flow chart.
And then it ends with a picture of Tim Russert. An example of how this type of subtle message works occurred during the October 2007 U.S. presidential debate. Tim Russert, described as the, quote, quintessential Washington insider, by Washington Post, asked Congressman Dennis Kucinich if he'd seen a UFO in a dismissive and trivializing way. The way the question was asked clearly stated to the world that the UFO subject was inappropriate and not worth serious consideration. Even Congressman Kucinich was forced to play down his actual UFO sighting in order to maintain some respectability. You can read more of this over at opednews.com. Again, the article is, are psychological operations used to influence public opinion on UFOs, of UFOs, by Franklin Fields. It's a pretty straightforward article. I mean, there's not much I would disagree about.
We're close to three quarters through the program, and you have yet to allude to libraries, which you said you had a lot of library material this evening. And
back on the 25th or 26th, I was pleased to discover that the founder of another radio show on the Anomaly Radio Network, John Greenwald Jr., who has a show called the Black Vault Radio Network, he was the then young upstart who started a vast repository, the Black Vault, of documents he obtained through Freedom of Information Act request. I think he may have requested more than anybody else out there. I don't know the stats on this, but he's gotten a lot of attention over the last year, finally, much deserved after years and years of slaving away. And he apparently has announced a new partnership with MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, the largest civilian UFO research organization on the planet. And basically he is hosting, and this I think is the start of many different items of the MUFON that he's going to host, and that is a online digitized downloadable archive of every past MUFON journal ever in PDF format, and it's fantastic. I've started downloading all of them myself for the Anomaly Archives, and he's got them segmented into the 1960s, 1970s, 80s, 90s, to 2000s. And in his recent newsletter, he announced, you know, that this was the first in an ongoing, long negotiated project. Now, I'm curious. I think Greenwald is, in fact, a nonprofit. I think he's just an independent who's got great ideas and is trying to do this on his own. And I support him, whether he's doing it as a for-profit or a nonprofit. But I'm curious, you know, about this relationship with the nonprofit MUFON organization.
I would just like to say I have no objection whatsoever to anybody making a living in the UFO or cryptozoological or paranormal
Hell
fields.
Hell yeah. Pay up. That was one of the things. You can find more about that over at anomalyradio.com. I've got a link to it, and theblackvault.com is the main place that this is up at, and you just look on the page for encyclopedia and you can find out more about that. Let's see. What other archives, library stuff? Somebody brought to my attention a study that's been posted online. It's dated September 2004, but I think it's not been online before, and that's Libraries and the Occult.
Oh, yes.
By Cecile Dubois.
Means White Woods. I'm sorry. That's Blanche Dubois.
Oh, okay. Submitted in partial fulfillment of the requirements of the degree of MA of University College London. And it's like a 90-some-odd page article, and whose abstract reads, "The principal aims of this study are to look at how libraries currently deal with occult collections and as to why such materials are still not widely available to the public through the library system. Its intent is to cover both historical and current collections, how libraries have dealt with them, and on the classification difficulties that arise from such a broad yet relatively untouched subject. A further section of the dissertation will consider some of the history of occult collections, on where they have gone to, on the changes or lack thereof between then and the present day, and on how some libraries advertise such collections whilst others still hide them away. Another aspect of the project will discuss some of the issues of censorship and how the occult field is under constant pressure to either remain hidden or to prove its validity and usefulness."
Well, remain hidden. That's the meaning of occult, right. I believe.
Well, but and here I think I don't know for sure how wide his anomaly net spreads for the phrase occult, but he goes on to say, "Here I will also consider some of the current controversies and the librarian's dilemma. The majority of the collections that I have been able to access and explore are based in London or in other parts of the United Kingdom. However, I have also incorporated studies on important collections that are housed overseas. In addition to both historical and present-day collections, a further section looks at the future of the occult collection with regard to online resources and current library building projects."
Ah, now that's interesting because it dovetails with something I read on The Economist the other day. It was a poll detailing the relative gulf between British attitudes and American attitudes. And one of the most interesting things that The Economist poll pointed up, and I don't know how large their sample was at home or abroad, but one of the implications of the survey seemed to be that the mass of the British populace was a lot more comfortable with giving up individual rights for enhanced security. You know, and you're looking at me like, well, of course The Economist is going to say that. You know, they are unabashedly capitalist.
Yeah,
but,
no, there's often some good reporting in there. I'm not denying that. Yeah. I mean, they're part of the revelation of the method, conspiratorially speaking. They're, you know, just saying, hey, this is what we're doing.
Yeah.
We're bending you over.
And they also had a very good obituary on Arthur C. Clarke.
Which we didn't, I don't think we mentioned in a previous episode.
I think we mentioned him passing away. I think. Anyway, if you didn't know, and you probably already do, Arthur C. Clarke, the great British science fiction author, resident for most of the last 30 years of Sri Lanka, passed away about a week ago now. He was known for the original story that was the source of the film 2001, The Space Odyssey. Wrote a very wonderful, very scary book about the future of humanity called Childhood's End. And the link to this article can be found at further Strange Attractor and Beyond, www.strangeattractor.co.uk/further.
And that's the libraries and the occult.
Mm-hmm.
There was something else. Oh, and we didn't mention Michael Corbin was a paranormal and parapolitical radio host who passed away March 18th. He had a show called A Closer Look, and it was very cool and active when I was just getting into the conspiracy internet community, and he'll be sorely missed. The other, I'm not sure what the other article I had about libraries was. What are you pointing to?
The comic book panel on the right.
Yeah, that's. I just think that's the
It's the icon for L.A. Muse, who I gather is the author of Strange Attractor and Beyond. But I want to read what the thought balloon says.
What does it say?
The print is a little too fine. It's
so-so. It's 50-50 whether they're going end up destroying each other or saving each other. I think it's time to tip the balance. It's
IWC, says the little hexagonal word balloon that's just floating with no character reference. Anyway, that's from L.A. Muse, is a new weekly online graphic novella from writer Adi Tantemed and artist Hugo Petrus. It's a lively, wise take on global activism, superpowers, celebrity cultures, and hyperdimensional reality. In other words, one smart, hip strip. Get it here.
Cool, I'm going to click there and go to... Oh, it's Big Head Press!
Big Head Press? Man.
Oh, dude, it's. I think I know somebody through these people. And anyway,
oh, okay.
It's cool.
Neat artwork.
It's multiple online comic books that they draw for delivery over the web at BigHitPress.com. Thoughtful stories, graphic novels, online and in print, and that's awesome.
And that's okay. La Muse. Sorry,
well, man.
Would you hoax a UFO sighting, Miles?
I've been hoaxed by a UFO sighting, and I might. I've definitely thought about it. That's a warning, everybody. I've come up with actually quite elaborate schemes. That's a question that Paul Kimball over at redstarfilms.blogspot.com was answering in his blog website. Would I hoax a UFO sighting? And we only have 4 minutes or left, but so I'm just going to touch on that was one thing else I wanted to mention. Over at beyondtheblog.wordpress.com, the writer's got a great article, What We Dream Of Is, that's pretty interesting takes on consciousness and parapsychology, as usual, over at Beyond the Blog. UFO ET situation described in Special Ops Manual, article by Steve Hammonds over at UFODigest.com. And I was going to – something I thought – I think what I was thinking of when I was thinking of anomalous libraries was finding out that recently here in Austin, somebody associated with the Abduction Monitoring Project that it's been around for a long time was speaking to the Austin chapter of the American Statistical Association, and that was Robert Powell was presenting on the abduction monitoring project research, design, and protocols. And Wayne Drews, I guess, talked on an introduction to cluster analysis. But this is, you know, a cool scientific local group, and who are hearing, they were hearing and seeing this PowerPoint presentation about the research and design protocols for the abduction monitoring project. And the abduction monitoring project was a black box scientific research experiment where people with a known and ongoing experiencing of the alien abduction phenomena would have this device wherever they most often were having their experiences in the home, usually in the bedroom, and it measured a variety of sensor data from gravity to temperature to humidity to you know, various other things, and it was an attempt to try to quantify any environmental effects associated with a claimed experiencing of a bedroom visitation style alien abduction experience. And that I was approached years, probably it was probably 10 years ago, by people who were starting this project, who I won't name, but who I respected, and I thought, wow, okay, this is the people I'd like to be involved with to research this. And though I didn't get to get involved, they were contacting me because of my association with the local support group for strange experiencers to perhaps provide them some specimens, some guinea pigs, some people who are having weird experiences to take part. But
I know is all I want is a girl just like Villers Boas.
Well, heck, man, it's that time.
Yeah, and I hope they're not listening. I was only kidding. spooky gray skin growling women. No, don't think so. No thanks. And really, I don't want to be an absentee father either.
Well, thanks for joining us, folks. This is Smiles Lewis.
Go out shaking like we always do.
Thanks for joining us. Good night.
Good night. Craig.